We hope and trust that you will find this Torah in Motion program meaningful. Through these programs, Torah in Motion encourages discussion, debate, and education about the most important issues facing Jews and Judaism today. Together, we can focus on creating religious commitment through an honest and sophisticated encounter with topics that are relevant to being Jewish in the modern world. For more information about this and other Torah in Motion programs, please visit the website at www.torahinmotion.org.
Mr. Feuerstein will tell you what I believe to be an incredible story. It's a story of a company that truly went above and beyond the law. It's a story I first heard 3 years ago at an academic conference on business ethics. And I have to tell you that it was a story that impressed me and overwhelmed me so much that to this day, I teach it to my business ethics students every time. Without any further ado, again, a great honor to introduce you to Mr. Aaron Feuerstein.
Thank you very much. Rabbi Kelman Jr. and Rabbi Kelman Sr., Dr. Tamari, Dr. Levine. What? All right, then I'll talk loud. In the mid-19th century, 1865 to be precise, the original founder of the Arlington Mills in Lawrence, Massachusetts, the very complex where Malden Mills is presently located, built the first mill there in Lawrence, Massachusetts. Lawrence was the woolen center of America, and New England was, at that time, the textile center of the world. He built that first mill back in 1865. Amazingly, a year later, in almost the same fashion as what happened to us in our fire, that first building burnt down. And the original owner, he immediately went forward and rebuilt the building, gave employment to the employees, supported the community. But interestingly, he went unpraised, unpublicized, and uncelebrated. He didn't have and didn't receive the celebrity status that I got. And I think about it, and I have to come to the conclusion that the praise that I received probably undeserved. It's a question of the timing. What was considered sort of normal back in the mid-19th century, at the close of the 20th century, in the beginning of the 21st century, is absolutely abnormal. That's why I got the praise, and that's why he didn't get it. The other conclusion I come to about the incident of the fire was that I received many thousands of letters from people all over America, people I didn't know, thoughtful people who wrote to me. And after reading them all and answering them all, I came to the conclusion that the common denominator of all these letters fact that these people gave their work, their loyalty, and trust to the corporation. And they wanted the same thing back from the corporation, and they didn't get it. They expected the modern-day CEO to act differently, to act the way we did at Malden Mills. And that's just a sad fact of life. The values that went into the decision-making at the time of the fire were probably incubated at my father's table. When I was a young boy growing up, my father and mother, two older brothers, two sisters, and I sat together every evening at the table. It was a great honor, and it was mandatory. We talked about everything. We talked about the family affairs, the religious affairs, how the kids were doing in school, etc. I remember when I was about 7 or 8 years old, my father related his experiences when he commenced work at age 14 in his father's business, the Malden Knitting Mills, which I am the third generation of, and there's a fourth generation as well today. He noticed that his father, at the end of work each day, went around to each employee and paid him his wages. So my father told his father, you know, that's not the way we're doing it today. You have to keep your accounting carefully, varying wages, varying hours, the benefits, the taxes, the union dues, etc. The only way it can be kept properly is to keep the records in the books and pay at the end of the week. And my grandfather refused to agree. He said, it's against the Torah. I was a little boy at the time. And the very next day, after my public school, I hurriedly that day went to my maternal grandfather, Rabbi Landau, who used to teach for a few hours a day my brother and I our Hebrew lessons. I asked my maternal grandfather, is it possible that the Torah says you can't pay the workers at the end of the week? And he says, yes. And he pulled out Devarim Kisetze, and he showed it to me. I subsequently committed it to memory. And what he showed me was, V'lo sashok sachir, you may not oppress the wage earner, the working man. Oni ve'evyon, he's poor, he's needy. Me'achecho u'migecho asher b'sherecho, from your brethren and from the non-Jew who's in the community. Biyomo sitein scharo, each day, daily, you have to give him his wages. Velo savo alav shemesh, and the sun should not set on those unpaid wages. Kiyonihu, because he's poor. Ve'elovu no se'ev a snuff show, and those wages actually sustain him as a human being. And he should not cry out against you to the Lord, and you will have transgressed. December 11th, 1995, the night of the fire, I was being honored at a surprise birthday party. It was my 70th birthday. It was given by my daughter. All my friends were there. When the word came out at 8 o'clock in the evening about the devastating fire, I was not told about it. My daughter didn't want her daddy to be disturbed. After work, after the party, I went home. 11 o'clock in the evening, telephone ringing. What a devastating fire there is at the mill. So naturally, I, Louise, my son Ray, we jumped in the car and went out to Lawrence. Lawrence is about 40 minutes north of Boston. As we arrived in Lawrence, there was a lot of traffic, a lot of smoke on the road. The whole community was out there in the roads, and I had to walk the last few blocks. When I got to the mill yard, I couldn't believe my eyes. There are three major finishing plants, each one containing approximately 250,000 square feet, were burning to the ground in front of my eyes in spite of the sprinkler devices and all the sophisticated equipment. It was totally out of control. They were gone. There was a strong easterly wind, cold, very furious, hurricane-like, which connected the fire of these three buildings into a large, what seemed like fire cloud, surrounded by the blackest smoke I ever saw ascending to heaven. I couldn't cry. I wanted to, but I couldn't cry. I thought of the lines of Shakespeare, King Lear's Shakespeare, "You think I'll weep? No, I'll not weep. I have full cause of weeping, but this heart shall break into 100,000 flaws, or ere I weep." For in that crying, you feel sorry for yourself, and that only leads to inactivity. If ever, that evening, I really had to be creative. I had to act and do something. And I began to work together with my managers there to figure out how could we sustain the business, save the people, save the community. What could we do? The finishing process that was in those three buildings was absolutely unique to our process, was necessary for our quality and performance, and without it, we couldn't stay in business. And I noticed that there was a fourth building which had some finishing equipment in it that was burning, but not with the same intensity as the other buildings. The fire was licking around the circumference of the building, but inside, the fire was not as intense. And we started to calculate how possibly we could save it. I turned to my director of engineering, Bill Demons, still with me, and I said, "What do you think the chances are of saving that building?" He looked at me and he said, "You know, Aaron, you've always been a dreamer. That building, together with the other three, will be burnt to the ground by 7 a.m. I was there at 7, and the building was standing. And standing as a tribute to to my workers, 27 heroes who were in that building all that night, and they saved it. And I know they made the difference. Over and above all the fire departments of northern Massachusetts and southern New Hampshire, they were the guys who did it. It was quite something. I went the very next day. I spoke to all my workers, and I told them that a decision's been made. We're going to stay in business. We're going to rebuild right there in Lawrence, Massachusetts, and we're going to support the community and support the workers. Ten days later, while I was working in my office, my director of manufacturing called me and said, come on over to Fin 2, that very building that was salvaged. And we're operating. The cloth is coming off of the finishing lines. I went over, opened the doors, heard the wonderful melody of the humming machinery, and there the cloth was coming off the line, and all my workers on both sides of that line and all my management people were all there with tears in their eyes and smiles on their faces. And I as well, with a tear in my eye, went up and down that line, shook hands with each and every one of them, and thanked them for their contribution. One of the workers came over to me and he said, don't thank us, Mr. Feuerstein. We're going to thank you, and we're going to pay you back tenfold. And so they did. They got us back into the business. They saved the operation. And in miraculously short time, we were able to rebuild right there in Lawrence, in the very area where all the other textile mills had fled for cheap labor. In our capitalistic system, the law of the land is maximizing the profitability of the shareholder. And you maximize that profitability without any consideration or without responsibility for the consequences of your workforce or of the community. The workforce just becomes a pair of hands. And you use the pair of hands as best you can. And wherever you can get that pair of hands cheaper, that's where you go. In our particular case, I'll finish shortly. In our particular case, we understand the maximizing of profitability to the shareholder, but we don't think of it always tomorrow morning. We think of it in a longer term. We consider our responsibility to the working man, and we consider him as our greatest asset, because we don't try to make a commodity type of product where our quality and our performance is exactly the same as everybody else's, and the only thing to do is to figure out how to make the product cheaper. What we do in the strategies of our business is, one, to innovate as much as we possibly can and with the greatest rapidity so that we can differentiate ourselves and distance ourselves from the commodity operation. And we combine this research and development with marketing, branding, and advertising. We're proud of what we do, and we brand it, and we want the final consumer to recognize the quality and the performance of what we do. And with these strategies, we're able to give consideration to the sensitivity to the human equation. And we're very proud of it. Let me conclude with the words of Jeremiah, written about 2,500 years ago. Al yisalel chacham b'chokhmaso. Let the wise man not praise himself for his wisdom. Ve'al yisalel agibor b'gvuraso. And let the powerful man not praise himself for his power. Ve'al yisalel oshir b'oshro. And let the rich man not praise himself for his wealth. Or to paraphrase it in modern terminology, let the modern day CEO not brag about his tremendous income. Ki im bezos yishalel hamishalel. If there's any kind of credit to be given out, it's in this. Haskel v'yadoa osi. Searching for the divine objective. Ki ani Hashem osa chesed. And that simply is acting compassionately. The midas harachmen. Osa chesed. Umishpot. And the legal judgment. And both together. The compassion and the legal judgment. Utstoka ba'aretz, and charity on this earth and in the environment. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I think the applause, it speaks for the inspiration that it should be for all of us in all of our dealings. Even if we're not a CEO or owner of a company, I think it's a wonderful model what we have to praise ourselves or what are the true values and the true ideals of life. Our final speaker before our panel is Rabbi Dr. Aaron Levine, who I owe a personal debt of gratitude. He is the one who originally introduced me to the field of Jewish business ethics, whatever we're going to call the field. I had him as a professor in Yeshiva University when I entered there, also at the age of 19, I think, after a year in Israel, where he taught a course on comparative economic systems. And it was a comparison between what a halachic economic system would actually look like. If the state of Israel, let's say, were to be run with all the areas of Shulchan Aruch of economics, what would it look like? Competition, all kinds of areas. And this is what, in many ways, it spurred my interest in the field. I became an accountant, a rabbi, but I've always had a tremendous interest in the combination of the world of finance and the world of Judaism. Rabbi Levine has been head of the economics department at Yeshiva University for about 20 years now, over 20. For 29 years as the head, I knew, okay. The head of the, for over 29 years, he's the author of a number of, even though he looks young, yes. He just married off a son a week ago, so I want to wish him a mazel tov on that. the last Sheva Brachas was only yesterday, so I want to thank him for coming so soon after the Simcha. And he's the author of a number of books, Free Market, Free Enterprise in Jewish Law, his most recent book, his case studies in Jewish business ethics. He is the rabbi of the Young Israel of Avenue Jane. Without further ado, Rabbi Dr. Aaron Levine.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Kelman. I would be remiss if I did not do the tradition of our religion of we open in honor of our host, my colleague and former student, Rabbi J. Kelman, is an individual that is always expanding his horizons and advancing in his Torah scholarship and his piety. And I'm really very grateful that he invited me to participate in this program. The Torah records its admonitions and prohibitions relating to business ethics in various specific prescriptions. But I would submit that we could really succinctly summarize all these prohibitions as being various nuances of a prohibition of not to exploit our fellow man. Exactly what that means, what the contexts are, the nuances are, that's the basis of almost all the prohibitions, just an expansion, an expounding of that idea. And business ethics is something for everyday life. It affects us in our decisions as consumers, workers, investors, employers. And I just want to run from one scenario to another to show you how this principle of to avoid exploitative behavior is really the common thread that runs throughout Jewish business ethics. Let's start with a scenario that a young couple want to buy furniture for their new home. And there are two types of furniture stores. There is a catalog store that offers no inventory and no expert salesman, just beautiful picture books that come from manufacturers. And another store that is a display store. We have in New York a store called Sloan's, the gigantic store, seven stories. In summer, the air conditioning is blasting away. There's millions of dollars of inventory there. Expert salesmen, they can tell you all kinds of ideas for ensembles if you buy something and ideas of financing. Well, this fellow goes to the catalog store, finds something to his liking in the picture book, and he hears the price. He loves it, but then he starts to hesitate and saying, well, you know, I don't want to spend this amount of money, $5,000, before I can actually see in the flesh what this looks like, this dining room set, and I want to have some ideas, ensembles, what could go along with it, some ideas, creative ideas of financing. And this fellow in the catalog says, shrugs his shoulder. He just knows nothing. What he can't tell him anything. He says, you know what? Go to Sloan's on the seventh floor, northeast corner. That's where the furniture that you're interested in is displayed. A salesperson will come along. You can ask him all your questions and come back to me and give me the order. Well, when the fellow goes to Sloan's, he's going there with an absolutely closed mind. He's pumping these salespeople for information. He's milking them, wanting to know ideas of ensembles and financing and whatnot. And this constitutes exploiting the salesperson. You're building up an expectation that a sale will take place, and all along you're not coming as a sincere comparative shopper. You're coming with a closed mind. And therefore, the aggravation, it's needless mental anguish that you're causing this fellow, because he's naturally going to be disappointed when there's no sale, whether it's going to be a person on commission or someone that is working on a salary. It makes no difference. The human nature is you're disappointed. And this disappointment is your responsibility because you came in with a closed mind. Lo sonu ish esachev. Don't cause your fellow Jew or fellow man needless mental anguish. Let's move to another scenario. Some bosses, not Mr. Furious, of course, some bosses think that they control their workers, at least for the time that they're working. And if a worker is in between assignments and the employer really can't tolerate that, and he feels that he has to give the worker something to do, which is called busy work, just for the sake of working. Like he might tell the worker, you know what, why don't you call up the customers that have not paid their bills and find out what's doing with them? Although the employer himself knows, he's the first one to snatch the mail in the morning. He knows that certain of these customers, the check has arrived. But the employee doesn't know that. That will be something for the employee to do, to get the employee to do work. So this is called useless work. And employer has no right to give this type of work to his employee. And you know why? Because our sages tell us, Ki li b'nei Yisrael avadim, that Hashem says that children of Israel are my servants, but you're not servants to servants. And what you're giving this fellow to do, you're rubbing in his sense of his dependency. And although the institution of Eved Ivri is moribund today, doesn't exist, but nevertheless, our sages regarded someone who contracts to work for fixed hours, that person, his state of employment is akin to servitude, because he feels bound by his employer and he can't escape. He has to work these fixed hours, in sharp contrast to what is called a koblen, a person who's paid for the finished job. He can set his own time. But a person who has to work for fixed hours, that person is akin to someone who is in a state of bondage. And we have to give him this liberty, this freedom. And some Chazal tell us a very amazing thing, that a worker, because we don't want him to feel like a bondsman, like a servant, we theoretically give him a right to retract in the middle of the day, that he should not feel bound to his work. And just to illustrate this, that suppose that he's hired for 4 hours and $5 an hour, that means that he's $20 for the day, and after 2 hours, this worker decides to quit. So he has a right to quit in the sense that he's paid for what he worked, the $10, and if the employer finds that it costs him more than $10 to hire a substitute worker, this is not the responsibility of the worker, the poel, who works for fixed hours. Now, don't get frightened. This is not a right that applies in a blanket way. There are many exceptions. If the motive of the worker is to get a higher wage elsewhere, he can't do it. He has no such right. He will be penalized. And if he is occupied in type of work that requires his immediate attention, and if not, it will cause a material loss. If he's working the mills, it will cause material loss if he quits. We also don't allow him to quit in this way without penalty. But it's psychologically soothing for the worker to know abstractly that he's not bound against his will to his employer, and under certain desperate conditions, he can leave. And that's comforting psychologically. So we have to be very careful with the worker. We can't rub in his state of dependency. And according to some authorities, it's not just a matter of going beyond the letter of the door. It's not a matter of just a party. It's a matter of halacha, that you're not allowed to do that, to rub in the state of dependency. Now, why don't we go a little further? That suppose the employer, he understands that it's degrading to give the worker busy work because he's rubbing in a state of dependency. He understands that. But if I have nothing to give you, I insist that you just sit and fiddle your thumbs at your desk. You can't make personal telephone calls in between assignments, and I won't even allow someone to call you. I'm sure Mr. Feuerstein doesn't have that attitude, right? In between assignments, you can make a little telephone call to your wife. Is that okay to do? Now, suppose this employer says no. After all, he can point chapter and verse, open up Maimonides, and Maimonides will tell us that the ideal worker, the paragon worker, is Jacob, our father, who never idled for a second on the job. And therefore, if I have nothing to give you and I'm paying you for the day, after all, I'm paying you, I don't want you to make any personal telephone calls. And suppose the employer, he doesn't prohibit it, and as I think I would be pretty safe to say that every employee in America feels free to do this in the absence of a explicit prohibition, especially that if there is a lull in the workflow, that the worker will say, you know, I have a chance, I'll call up my wife and say hello to her, call up my parents, say hello. I don't think there's a single person that doesn't do that. I'm not going to make you feel guilty about that. I would suggest that this is certainly permissible, because in this minimal way I'm talking about, not abusing it, in between assignments, when there's no workflow at that time. Because in modern times, this right that the Torah gives the worker, that he has a right to retract in the middle of the day without penalty, I would submit to you, is an empty right in every sense of the word. Because what worker in his sane mind would quit in the middle of the day? This is an empty right. Today, if you quit the job, you're in for a nice period of job search and a lot of aggravation to get another job. That's the nature of the modern job labor market. What does this have any meaning today, that the worker can theoretically retract in the middle of the day? And that's supposed to be psychologically comforting. I would ask you, does it have any meaning whatsoever today? And yet the Torah wants the worker to feel, at least under certain conditions, he can do that, and that way he will not feel that working for fixed hours is akin to servitude. But what meaning does it have today? So I would suggest that unless you give him this right as a minimum to be in contact, to have access to the outside world, to be in contact with his spouse, to his parents, and to take a call, somebody, if something important, someone calls him. If you don't give him these rights, then the worker will really feel a sense of bondage. And I'm sure Mr. Feuerstein would allow the worker to make a call. A sense of bondage. And, you know, there are economic studies that really support this idea that in undeveloped countries, when workers are paid below subsistence, and employers in the sweatshops in Vietnam, they can get away with that. Sierra Leone, there is an actual academic study that shows that if the employer increases the wage to the level of subsistence, there is a tremendous increase in productivity. Because a worker at that level, he's so undernourished, so there's a mutual gain that's had. The worker raises the wage and he gains as a tremendous investment. And this is the same thing here. The Torah, so farsighted, so understanding of human nature, understands that if a person is bound against his will, feels that he's shackled, he's chained, he can't have any contact with the outside world, that if you allow him this minimum privilege, that will be so psychologically comforting that there will be actually a mutual gain for the employer. Let's take another situation. Someone is working as a salesman for a computer hardware company. So he's very knowledgeable about laptops and desktops and a lot of technical information. He's working for a firm for a long time, calling up corporations, maybe Moulton Mills he's calling up, do you need some laptops? And he has all the technical information, contacts, and most of all, the reliability, because when you give them an order, so the company that he works for, we'll call it Alpha Company, they're able to deliver the computer hardware very quickly, and they take care of the financing, so there's a very satisfactory type of thing. Now this worker, he decides he wants to go out on his own or work for another company. And he has so many nice contacts, so many good relationships with Mr. Feuerstein. He has a good relationship. So he wants to go out on his own. Now, is it ethical to do that? Is this exploiting the employer by just doing this, suddenly leaving him? And the answer is, of course it is, because there's two problems here. One, perhaps Joe, who's working for Alpha, maybe he's the only guy that makes these calls. He's the only hardware rep that's doing this. And what he does, and suddenly leaving, is leaving the company flat and is very disruptive, what he's doing. And you know what the Talmud says? That when someone wants to compete, we don't protect people from competition, because the person who wants to compete can say, just like you, who has been here before, you operate in your premises and produce a product, I have the same right to operate in my premises and produce a product. That's the phrase that the Talmud uses. Now, if I'm going to leave my company and there's no one else that could take over for me that has this expertise, and this is going to be tremendously disruptive, it's tantamount that I decide to compete with Alpha by creeping into Alpha's premises and using all their facilities. That's really what I'm using. Because there's no one else, I'm crippling the company. I'm competing by actually invading their premises and using their employees. That's really what it's equivalent to doing. So it's unethical, it's exploitative. And suppose there is someone else there. There's another problem. It's not disruptive, but there's a lot of the goodwill of Alpha that's embedded in Joe. They have a lot of satisfying relationships that have taken place because Joe is really piggybacking on the goodwill of the company, the reliability of the company, and all the technical knowledge that he picks up. And when he leaves and he wants to call up someone, when they hear his voice, whose voice are they hearing? When he picks up and calls Mr. Feuerstein, Mr. Feuerstein is saying, it's Alpha that's calling. It's not Joe that's calling. It's Alpha that's calling. So what Joe is doing is, he is expropriating the goodwill of Alpha for his own commercial interests. That's unethical. So what should he do? If Joe wants to go out on the business himself, if he's going to pick up the phone, call any customer, and tell them that the first thing when they hear his voice, when he says hello, they're hearing Alpha. And if at the end of the conversation he said, by the way, I'm no longer working with Alpha, I'm working with another company, he has done the damage. He has already expropriated the goodwill of Alpha for his own purposes. So what it would seem that we have here, a situation where we have to only compete on the basis of not exploiting the goodwill and not disrupting a company. So what if there is no one to take over? Then there is a waiting period that Joe just can't go suddenly and take away the business. He has to give, and there's a professor of Harvard, Professor Blake, who has proposed this in the secular literature. Wait until the company can restore their goodwill in another person and show customers that they're reliable because they have a new fellow, Fred, who can do the job. Then only then can Joe start competing. Because if he doesn't do that, he's really creeping into Alpha's premises and using their personnel to do the job. And in the second, the suspension of the goodwill can only be prevented if when Joe calls up and the first thing that he says is that he is leaving the company, he has to, I would say, to be very ethical, what he should do is, when he calls up, in case they have an order to make at that point, first take the order and ask them if they have anything they want to order. And then he should let the people know that he's leaving and he's going in the same business. And if there's someone else in Alpha that can take over the accounts, then it's competition on a level field. And this would be an ethical way of leaving a company, taking care of these two problems, disruption and exploiting the goodwill of a prior employer. Let me just give you one more scenario, and I think this is probably the most important of all. When you talk about concept of exploitation, I think the most serious thing to avoid is we shouldn't let ourselves be exploited by values that are alien to our Torah. And to give let's give an example, an investment to show how this applies. That Rav Soloveitchik has pointed out, Rav Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, that when the Torah gives a blessing to Adam and says that Pru Ruvu Melu Es Aretz, be fruitful and multiply and fill up the earth, V'kivshua, and subdue nature. This is not just a blessing, it's a mandate that when man is coupled with nature, that is a hapless and hopeless existence and cannot achieve for man any sense of dignity if man can subdue nature, he can conquer nature, then that's a dignified, magnificent existence, and dignity by itself, though, has no value unless it leads to a heightened sense of responsibility. And how do we subdue nature in the modern world? It's the whole economic system that does so. When someone has a job and he earns income, earning that income gives a person command over the entire standard of living that society has to offer, and immediately confers that person, subduing nature, with a dignified existence. But dignity alone is nothing. It allows the person to fulfill responsibilities. Once the person earns income and he has command over the goods and services of the economy, he can also fulfill his responsibilities to fellow men. So in economics, we are very neutral of what constitutes the legitimate economic activity. We can't say what has inherent value in economic activity. If you make money, then it's important. If you don't make money, it's degraded. It's not important. But from the standpoint of Ralph Salvage's criteria, what has inherent worth if your job, yes, it earns you income and it heightens your sense of responsibility? This criteria is critical in the world of investment. That if somebody wants, for example, to invest as a small, insignificant investor in tobacco stocks, he wants to earn some money based on the price-earnings ratio that was beaten down. It's a great investment to take advantage of the low point in the price-earnings ratio to make some money. What would be wrong in doing that if technically this person is an insignificant shareholder? He's not an owner. He's not responsible for the policies of the company. Why should this be prohibited? But from the standpoint of ideology, philosophy, it's a terrible thing, because once a person makes such an investment in the company, he will naturally be rooting and cheering on events that will have the effect of relaxing the regulatory environment of cigarette smoking. That's something that will make the stocks go up. On the other hand, he will become terribly depressed the more lawsuits are launched, the more trouble that the government gives the tobacco companies, and erasing this terrible smoking, all the medical problems, the cancer and the heart disease that it causes, all anything that will slow down the regulating of the tobacco companies will sadden this person. Could you imagine what kind of person this fellow is when human misery gives him a few dollars and makes him happy that the stock is going up? You know, in 1980, everyone was buying gold and silver. And when Russia invaded Afghanistan in 1980, that was a record day for gold. It went up $88 in a single day. Could you imagine that if someone invests in gold, world turmoil is war and instability and misery is what makes the commodity go up? What kind of a person emerges from that? Is this enhanced dignity, this enhanced responsibility that results? principles of Jewish business ethics in our daily lives. Thank you.
All right, I'm assigned. We will take now any questions on the topics they have directly addressed or indirectly addressed, anything you'd like to ask. If you want to tell us who you're addressing to on a specific level, you can. If not, just ask a general question. We'll take a few questions at once, so don't be shy. Yes. And I'll give our speakers pens and paper so they can write down notes that apply to them. Here. Yeah, oh, go ahead. You can please speak loud if we can maybe like get the microphone to the speakers just for our taping system. Maybe you want to, is that possible? Does it stretch that far? It won't stretch. Okay. All right. Ask loudly.
First question about RBIS prohibited. Any interest payment is prohibited, not just usury, excessive interest. The distinction the gentleman brought between our treatment of a Jew and a non-Jew, first of all, the premise itself that the Shulchan Aruch quotes that if the non-Jew had done us favors in the past, then we should lend him as pious thing to do, money without interest. In other words, it's not something that is required. In fact, it is the right thing to do to repay a kindness and lend him money without interest. Now, the distinction itself, Rav Chaim Volozhin, who was the primary Talmud of the Gaon of Vilna, points out that the whole idea of the prohibition of interest is a coercive type of chesed that we are required to do members of our clan, members of our family. It is not something on the level of a type of way that the market system should work. It is a required chesed, and this type of enforced chesed is only something we have to do to members of our own clan, and we are not required to do this for a non-Jew. That's how he explains the difference. And also, there's no element of discrimination whatsoever that's involved here, because when we lend money to a non-Jew, we're allowed to charge him interest. If a non-Jew lends money to us, even in the Jewish society, we have total control. There's nothing wrong that the non-Jew should charge us interest. So therefore, it's not a one-way street. In all dealings with the non-Jew, there can be interest, whether we're in the paying end or the receiving end. So there's no discrimination whatsoever that's involved. And in terms of a requirement to charge the non-Jew interest, there's no such requirement. In fact, sometimes it's the right thing to do not to charge him interest as a matter of repaying chesed that he did to us. Now, the second question about the day worker when he did a bad job, is that the question? No, it doesn't say ochicho. It says lanochri as a. All right, and the question is, that's technically speaking, there might be a difference between the issue of onor. There actually is two types of onor. That what you're referring to is onor's mama, that is monetary fraud, when there is a competitive price and there's either an overcharge or an undercharge, whether that applies to a non-Jew. Now, most hold that the restitution procedure that our sages establish, which is if it's more than a sixth, the transaction becomes null and void. It's exactly a sixth, it remains intact. The differential return less than a sixth, there's a waiver, presumption of waiver. That's the only thing that does not apply to a non-Jew, but on a theoretical level. But as far as the prohibition of exploiting him, in other words, if you know of the difference in the price of the marketplace, you cannot exploit the ignorance of the non-Jew. And all this is on a theoretical level, but clearly, and when there is a Chil Hashem, when we make distinctions in our commercial dealings between Jews and non-Jews, and this is something that is visible, is clearly a very serious prohibition to discriminate. We have to treat the Jews and non-Jews exactly the same. And I want to just mention this, that I've done many cases in a judicial role in Bergen County, New Jersey, together with colleagues at the Yeshiva University, regarding infringement of competition. That is when a new store opens, whether that is going to infringe upon an established store, what kind of rules, what kind of protection we can give an established, this is called fair competition. There's many, many, many suits that are there, and the Rabbinical Council of Bergen County, they actually have a lot of leverage because they give the rabbinical hechsher for the food of these stores, so therefore all these monetary matters have to be settled before they get hechsher, so they have very good leverage there. They decided early on that they would make no distinction whatsoever between, for example, the Chinese restaurants that were opening there and that are owned by non-Jews. They would make absolutely no distinctions because would be the biggest chil Hashem to say, well, the rules of fair competition apply between Jews, but when it is a question of a non-Jew, we have no interest in protecting him. And technically, that is so. But we have to be always sensitive of the Kiddush Hashem. And we also have to be sensitive of in the positive sense, of not avoiding Chil Hashem, but making a Kiddush Hashem, as Mr. Feuerstein has done. Making a Kiddush Hashem is the greatest thing we could do in these times. And for example, if you have a bank teller will give you some more money than you're supposed to get, and they're doing hundreds of transactions a day, and they won't know the difference. If you return the money, it's a Kiddush Hashem. So we have to be looking not just to avoid Chilul Hashem, but to make a Kiddush Hashem. You have the next question about the day worker, about the job that wasn't done right? Is that the question? Okay, now that's dealt with in the Shulchan Aruch when the classical example is that if you give an artisan wool and you say, I want you to dye it red, and he dyes it black. So if he makes any kind of change which makes a difference, because some things are trivial, like we're talking about a painting job when you have a very fine difference in shade of color, when most people would not be makbid at all on that. If it's something that's the rule, if we have presumption that people are particular about this, in other words, it is a change, it makes a difference, then the only thing that the worker gets is his expenses that he incurred, and he gets or whatever the improvement in the value of this raw material was, whichever is the lesser of the two, that's what he gets. So if a person notices immediately, he can do that immediately, and if he doesn't notice it, he can still have a remedy after the fact as well. So there's always a remedy. When the workmanship is poor, does not meet the standards, there's always an adjustment that's called for. It doesn't make a difference if it's discovered before or after. And I think that the next question was a very easy one about, what was it, about Lo Sonu, before that, there was a question about also about Lo Sonu, about the meaning of the source. Okay, that's Lo Sonu. See, actually, the word Lo Sonu is repeated twice in the Torah, once in Kedoshim and once in Behar. So it's understood, it's not a repetition, but the first time he speaks about monetary fraud, I mean, as mentioned before, and the second he speaks about causing someone needless mental anguish. Many, many examples are given of that. Of course, one of them is that you should not ask a wise person a question that he won't know the answer to. So keep that in mind too, also, because you embarrass him. Okay, and then the last thing is stealing. Now, I really want to be very careful to repeat what I said about the telephone calls. We're talking about, I got the approval of Mr. Feuerstein. We were talking about between assignments. You're not stealing the time of the employer. The employer just has a begrudging attitude that you shouldn't be sitting there idle because he's paying you for the whole day. We're talking about only that. We're talking about this minimal privilege, and we're not talking about interrupting your work and calling. That's stealing the employer's time. We're talking about between assignments, and we're not talking about abusing it. We're talking about in a minimal way. And why do I say that it's permissible? Two reasons. One is that without giving the worker this privilege, he would truly feel shackled. He is excommunicado. He is cut off from the world. And therefore, he would feel that working these fixed hours is really chaining him to the place. And second, all the economic studies would show that when you start out on a condition, which I don't think anyone in this room, in this base manager here, is subject to, the employer doesn't give you such a rule that you can't make in between assignments a very brief personal call, that if you're starting out with that condition imposed and then you remove it, I think there would be a tremendous increase in productivity of the worker. So therefore, there is a mutual gain. The employer will gain tremendously. When Henry Ford introduced in 1914 the $5 workday, there was, and that cost them $10 million in 1914 to do that, there was a tremendous 60% increase in productivity of his workers over that year, and it's documented in Rad and Summers, their article in 1987. So I think it's akin to that. If you start off with the mean employer who has that rule, and then he decides with the goodness of his heart to remove that rule, there's going to be a tremendous jump in productivity and a big reduction in turnover rate that he probably can't even retain one worker if he has such a rule. There's a question to Mr. Feuerstein about corporate America.
Yes, I think there's a question about corporate America. Probably it's in reference to the fact that after the fire, there was a great deal of rebuilding necessary, and a lot of our employees, the regular union laborers, did not have employment until the rebuilding was completed. And so we had a policy in Malden of a paying our people during this interim. And what was corporate America's reaction? I don't know. I ask myself that question very often, but probably if it were a public corporation, I, the CEO, would have been fired.
With your permission, I'd like to go back to the question of the interest. It's true that Torah says that you're allowed to lend money to a non-Jew and charge him interest, and you're not allowed to do it to a Jew. And very often in mixed societies, when I say mixed, I don't mean mixed by color or by sex, I mean by Jews or non-Jews, then this question comes up of a dual morality. With your Jews, you do A, and with a Gentile, you do B. The two examples that you, the questions that you asked, are not identical. To a non-Jew, as Dr. Levine said, you're not allowed to do those things which are bad. So you're not allowed to steal from a non-Jew, you're not allowed to rob him, you're not allowed to lie to him. There is no dual morality in those things. However, there's nothing wrong with charging interest. As a matter of fact, none of us would like to live in a society in which there is no interest. The Israeli economy went through that for many years. You wanted to buy a house, there was no mortgage money. Everybody had to chip in, fathers, mothers, uncles, cousins, so that you could buy a home. And our children in this country walked into the mortgage company, borrowed 90% of them, and they said, thank you very much. So that the question of charging interest as an immoral act is only immoral if you think that the interest is evil. And then you wouldn't be allowed to do it to a Jew, to a non-Jew. So that this question of lending money to a non-Jew at interest is a fictitious theory that it's beneficial. And therefore, there wouldn't be anything wrong with it. And we can see it better. If I lend you money, not in the form of money, but in the form of capital, I buy a building and I lend you stay in my apartment. Am I allowed to charge Jews rent? Yes. I have heavy equipment and I rent it out to you. Am I allowed to charge you? Yes. And in the non-Anglo-Saxon languages, rent and interest are the same word. And that's what they are in economics. Came the Torah, made a special case of lending money in the form of money. And as has been said, this was a form of charity. And charity, I can't support the whole world. As was explained, a two-way street. The Onai is different. The Onai is not fraud, because that you're not allowed to do to a non-Jew. There is a question of overcharging above the marketplace or above, another example, above a certain rate of profit. And yeah, this is a concession, if you want to put it that way. It's a form of mutual charity, as in the case of Ribit. The question of the worker who didn't do his job properly. There's a legal attitude that has been explained. I would like to add another dimension. There's a famous discussion in the Gemara about a person who hired porters to carry wine. Not only did they do a bad job, but they dropped the casks and broke them. So the owner did what you probably would have liked to do. He took their cloaks in order to sell them to pay him for what the damage that had been done. And they went to a din Torah, and the rab said, give them back their cloaks. I said, what do you mean? Guy did me damage. He says, yes, but there is an obligation on a Jew that you should go in right ways, in good ways, in straight ways. These are Jewish workers. They weren't only satisfied with getting back their cloaks. And they said, we worked the whole day. What about our wages? So then he said, what do you mean? They broke my wine casks. I gave them back their things. I still got to pay them. So the rabbi said, yes, they're poor. They don't have what to eat. Pay them. He said, it's a din? He says, yes, because you're supposed to go in great ways, in honest ways, in straight ways. So we always have to understand that over and above the legal obligations, over and above the legal rights, there are also another dimension which for religious Jews is as much an obligation as the legal rights.
I'd like to add an element of to be a little provocative here, and the chair fell down to show that what I'm about to do, with all due respect, I would like to differ with my colleague, Dr. Tamari, that, you know, invoking Lefnim Mishur HaSadin above the letter of the law, there actually is, within that standard, there are different levels. And there is a level that we only would expect from the very elite of society. The Torah is given to human beings, and we expect them to do what is justice and what is right. And as Mr. Furiously said, compassion is a concept, lefnim mishur hadin, above the letter of the law. But there are parameters, there are limits of the above, for the ordinary man, what the above the letter of the law means. And as Tosfos in Above Metzia, Chof Dal Amud Beis, tells us that what does lefnim mishur hadin tell us? That we require of everyone that he should exert himself, toil and effort, beyond the letter of the law. As the example of the father of Shmuel, that he found an animal and he took care of it for 12 months. He gave it out to work, and the money he used to feed it. This is a big bother, a major expenditure of toil and effort for a whole year. And that's all you're required to do. And he decided, according to the Hashava Saved, the law of Hashava, he decided to go beyond that, not to sell the animal and to keep on doing this until still hoping that the owner would return. Toil and effort is what consists of the law of Lefnim Mishur HaSadin. But as Tosfos says, when you are to go beyond that, to expect someone an expenditure, to incur an expenditure, that is only something that we could demand of the elite of society. And this is exactly what we have in the story and that Dr. Tamari related, which is related above Messiah Daf Pei Dalet, that the psukim, the verses that are invoked there, is not Vosis of Yoshva Tov, which is the basis of Lefnim Shadon, or Saderach HaSheyelcho, Hamas HaSheyason, which is another source of it, but rather it's a pasuk, a verse in Mishle that says, Orcha Sadikin Tishmar, that pasuk. And so this is the idea of Laman Yelach B'derech Tovim, V'Orchos Sadikin Tishmar. This is a higher level of Nifnim Mishur HaSadin.
People want to come up and ask questions, that's fine. I will let you know, those who are interested, there are two programs, so tomorrow actually, which in the morning, Rabbi Levine will be at Eishet Torah about 8:30 in the morning giving a 3-hour question and answer seminar. Real issues. You know, any question you want to ask, he has a few topics he'll be presenting. It's going to be an Asia tour on Clark. There's also a corporate luncheon you have to reserve. I don't think there are too many spaces left. At 12 o'clock at PricewaterhouseCoopers at the Royal Trust Tower downtown, where Mayor Tamari and Mr. Feuerstein will be speaking at a corporate luncheon at Pricewaterhouse. If you are interested in attending, call up the Federation and make a reservation if there are places available. There are refreshments, I think, upstairs and downstairs. I don't know where they're more. They are downstairs. Okay. Fruit, cake, all kinds of good refreshments. Everybody's welcome downstairs. Our speakers are here. We'll dub in Mariv in a few minutes. I don't know when exactly. In the base medrash, we'll dub in Mariv. And thank you all for coming. Okay.